Linoleum Life.
A podcast of the cinema.
What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm a film reviews editor at The Wrap, film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick, co-host of Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network.
You're everywhere now.
It's a little bananas.
You're the James Franco of this house.
I like jobs.
You like all the jobs. You've got all the jobs.
I don't do nearly as good a Tommy Wiseau impersonation. And who are you?
Dave White. I have one job. I had one job.
You have several jobs.
I have this job. This is a job.
And you also.
And I write for The Wrap,
yes,
too.
This week, you reviewed.
I wrote a review of Woodshot.
Yes,
this
you did.
Week.
We'll be talking about that later. But first, we're going to talk to our very special guest.
We have a guest.
Yes. Joining us once again, a friend of the show. If you've been listening for a while, you'll have heard his dulcet tones. But if not, please welcome from Variety, Mr. Peter DeBruges. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, guys. Glad to be here.
Always a pleasure. You just came back from the Toronto International Film Festival, and neither of us went, so we want the dirt. What was good? What'd you like?
I did the double whammy, the Labor Day weekend festival beforehand, Telluride. Which
oh,
is
really?
My
okay.
Favorite festival on earth, and the one that if for some reason someone yanked this carpet out from under me and I was jobless, I would still be going to. It happens over Labor Day weekend in the Colorado heights, high altitude, you know, thin air. And they don't announce the lineup until you get there, so right. It's a mystery. But their track record is incredible. Eight of the last 10 Best Picture nominees have either world premiered there, as did Argo and Moonlight.
Or winners, you mean?
Sorry, that's what I mean. Yeah. Winners of the last 10 years. Or have made their sort of North American debuts there, pre-Toronto.
Right.
Sometimes right after
Venice. Venice has snagged a few, I know.
Yeah.
Cool. And so, all right, well, let's start with Telluride. What was everybody talking about there? What did
I have,
you like?
I have a really important question about Telluride first, though. Do you have to take, like, a little plane to get there?
Well, no. There's a charter that we all take, and then it flies into, Montrose, and then you sort of bus out from there. But there is world's scariest airport there in Telluride, and it is short runway,
right.
Steep cliff, and you see it as you're sort of, like, taking the gondola over the mountain.
Yeah.
There is this thing that you think, oh, my God, if I ever had to take that... And I think movie stars have had to do it. And it's like a little 12-seater plane or something that revs up its acceleration.
No.
The runway ends. It dips down and catches, the...
And this is how I know I will never go to Telluride.
There you are, just ruined it for
there
me.
There are other ways to get there. But I drove last year. Which
you can drive the whole way?
Which was 14
from Los
hours.
Los Angeles to Telluride, you could drive all the way up the hill?
We stopped at halfway, did, the Grand Canyon. There's Monument Valley on the way, if you care for that.
Dave's a big John Ford fan. So, all right. So, yeah. So, one can drive, Dave White. There is that as an option.
All right.
Okay. So, this year, what'd you see? What was amazing?
Well, so this year, the films that kicked... It was sort of the year of the boring biopic. And I feel like I sort of drew the shorter straw this
Isn't
time around.
Every year the year of the boring biopic?
It's true, and that like movies like, Albert Nobbs and such, have sort of launched there in the past. It's not all Oscar Best Picture winners. But this year, Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig's directorial debut.
I hear things.
Is terrific. She's the actress who... she's the actress who appeared in Mistress America. And, I mean, she'd done...
Frances Ha.
A dozen very small mumblecore movies. That
Arthur.
Yes, let's never forget the Arthur remake.
I think she's an enormously talented actress
she
who
really
feels
is.
Like, someone that we know. She plays that so well, and she doesn't play that aloof, distant, you know, kind of elite movie star thing that where they, you know, it's like she's someone I know from college or can play that really well. Right. Here she's basically fictionalizing her own adolescence, you know, mm-hmm. growing up in Sacramento. And it's Saoirse Ronan, who's kind of like, you know, the star of the fall festival circuit, it turns out, you know, the who plays the, you know, a character who calls herself Lady Bird and, you know, who is, you know, kind of just, you know, figuring out
that happens all the time.
Yeah, please. We clonk the table, the dogs will bark, it's a thing.
Don't anyway, so she's playing, you know, just a young lady who's like figuring out her sexuality, figuring out, you know, what she wants to do with the rest of her life, and distinguishing herself from, you know, the, you know, her mother, who is played by Laurie Metcalf.
Ooh.
Who, as a film critic and not a television critic, I felt like
out.
I was discovering, you know, it's like and for me, this is, you know, the supporting performance of the Fall Festival circuit is Laurie right. Metcalf right. as her mother. You know?
But she also does a lot of theater.
I have just somehow missed out on all the talent that is Laurie Metcalf.
Oh, okay.
Did you not watch
Horace and Pete, the Louis C.K. show that he did, which I think is now all streaming on Hulu? Like, go watch her. I think it's episode 3. She has this, like, most of the episode is her monologue, and it's just riveting.
Great. I mean, like,
you're not a Roseanne watcher, are you?
Well, my story is that I grew up not being allowed to watch television. So the whole chapter where, you know, Roseanne was on and a thing, you know, is sort of like in the black hole of my, you know, kind of like media.
Okay, well, hang on, Paul Schrader. When did you start watching movies then?
Well, movies were an infrequent thing, you know, throughout my childhood. It was, you know, kind of like the era when you had to, I'm not so ancient, but it, like, we would rent a VCR for the weekend and five
oh,
tapes
wow.
or something.
Oh.
Take it home, hook it up to the little black and white television set we had. I mean, it sounds like I'm from another century. I mean, I guess technically we all aren't. But and then, you know, there were the kind of like, you know, curated outings to the movies or what have you. But it wasn't until I was in sort of high school when I was, you know, sort of could feed my appetite. And by that point, I had skipped over all the garbage, I think, that just is white noise on television, HBO, what have you, cable, and went straight to kind of like the Miramax rack or something.
Huh. Are there moments with people your age where they are making references to Full House or something, and you're just completely not getting what they're talking about?
Constantly. And as you guys know, you know, like, I went and lived for 2 years abroad in Paris.
Right.
And one
right.
of the things that was fascinating to me about that experience is that that thing that naturally happens when you're interacting with people in another country whose pop culture references and everything are different from yours
yeah.
is basically a phenomenon I've experienced my entire life as someone who just doesn't have MTV or television as part of my,
oh,
you
wow.
know.
So you're always a foreigner.
Yeah, more or less. But I think in a way it's sort of like it's set up a certain predisposition as a critic where it's like, you know, the way I've always watched film has been with, I don't know, like a more analytical, skeptical eye. I would go over to my friends' houses, you know, just to hang out on a weekend or something, and I would be like, you know, interrogating the commercials. It's like, it doesn't make sense. That product doesn't think it did. It's like they had just seen that commercial 1,000 times and be like, shut up, Peter. It's like, you know, what are you talking about? Like, yeah. But
okay, so Lady Bird, what else?
So Telluride also launched Battle of the Sexes, which is, you know, one of a couple tennis movies. Toronto opened with Borg versus McEnroe.
Oh, right, right,
Borg,
right.
McEnroe. The Battle of the Sexes for me is, they're both actually really strong and really well acted. But sports is another thing I know nothing about. Who are we?
Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs.
Thank you very much. This is, you know, this sort of landmark, you know, male versus female match, and it,
right.
you know, and it does such a great job, I think, of setting up the, you know, the kind of political context of, you know, a moment where, not to mention that we now know that Billie Jean King, you know, at the time was basically discovering her own sexuality and,
right.
you know, exploring, as the movie shows it, I don't know how accurate this, you know, it may be a composite or who knows what, but it's, you know, her hairdresser.
No, that's a real character.
Okay. And I think, you know, that just gives all this dimension to a movie that, you know, has the payoff of a big sports competition at the end, but along the way, you know, this is from the directors of Little Miss Sunshine, which
right.
is a movie I didn't particularly love, but I think that, you know, their style is really improving as they go, and they are real filmmakers, you know.
Because I loved Little Miss Sunshine, but I did not care for Ruby Sparks.
Yeah, right.
So, but I've heard good things about this one. It opened this weekend, but Dave and I haven't seen it yet. We're going to get to it later on in a future episode. Did you by chance see the HBO version from several years ago?
No. So there's a
When Billy Beat Bobby with Jane Anderson did, and it's Holly Hunter and Ron Silver.
Interesting. I don't know, you know, to what extent the story really fascinates me, and that's one of those things where I was really kind of groaning going into both of those tennis movies, and they both won me over completely. They're
cool.
You know, in their own separate ways, really gripping. The Borg McEnroe movie, like really uses Shia LaBeouf's kind of most obnoxious qualities to its advantage, you know?
Yeah, when I heard he was playing John McEnroe, I was like, yeah, that scans.
Right. I mean, he's just like an abrasively obnoxious, you know.
Which Skarsgård plays Bjorn Borg?
And in a way, like Steve Carell as Bobby Riggs is kind of a great usage as well, because he's basically a professional clown, you know, at the tail end of his career, you know, just hamming it up and doing all these stunts on courts. And I mean, I think he looked at playing a female athlete as another one of these stunts, only to be put in his place, you know.
No, actually, I was kidding. Who does play Bjorn Borg?
Oh, sorry. You know, it's a Danish actor.
Oh, okay.
I think I don't know, but I'll be putting posters of him up on my bedroom walls shortly. I mean, he's appropriately handsome.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Let's see, what else was great out of? You will have seen The Shape of Water, the Guillermo del Toro movie at Venice, and that, you know, played Telluride in Toronto. I adore that movie.
Loved it.
And del Toro is one of those guys who I've just been waiting to love one of his movies, I think. You know?
Yeah, I like the idea of him more than the stuff he makes.
Somehow they don't quite deliver on the promise that they set up, and this one I think it fully does. You know, he just finds this kind of poetic undercurrent about... It's like an ode to outsiders and to invisible people, and the way that multiple characters fit that bill and come together to kind of overpower the man in this movie.
Yeah, in a very sort of conformist era where if you aren't like a straight white guy, you're on the fringes and have those people sort of find, you know, they empower themselves. It's pretty great.
Right. I mean, for me, that's the closest to a movie I would hope to see in the Best Picture race out of the sort of Telluride.
Sure.
It opened with the same film that opened Venice, which is Alexander Payne's Downsizing, which to me is maybe the biggest disappointment of the fall festival season.
I liked it more than most people did. I thought it actually worked. I mean, it's a different kind of film from him, but when it opens at Christmas time, we'll go deep on this one. But I don't know. I thought it was effective. Did you like the first part and then it falls apart, or did none of it work for you?
I don't think like even the premise doesn't work for me, and it kind of like was a sequence of, you know, every time there was a decision to be made, they made the wrong one. I don't think, you know, there's a human on earth who would quote get small, and even the premise that you would do it to sort of like it, you also get rich in the process. You know, like something about that, you know, is phony to me, because I don't think like the trick to having a bigger diamond is making yourself smaller. You know, it's like...
if you can turn one diamond into a whole bunch of little tiny, teeny, teeny, tiny diamonds, then yes.
I still think, like, someone who is so status-oriented as that, you know, is, like, going to recognize that a grain of sand-sized diamond is a grain of sand-sized diamond. It's not an appropriate engagement gift. You know, it's like... But more than anything, the whole thing hinges on this twist that we're not allowed to talk about, and it's way too early in the film's life, but it's like, you know, the first act twist, basically, he just ignores this thing that happens to him and goes off in a different direction.
I think I gave that away in my review because it happened early enough in the film, but oh well.
Yeah,
we won't talk about that. The movie that I found disappointing of this spate of stuff was Suburbicon.
I haven't seen that, no.
Yeah, I thought that was did not work at all.
That's sort of the word on the street. And, you know, another one that disappointed me, I mean, unfortunately, is Andrew Hayes' new movie, Lean on Pete.
Really?
I really like his style in general, but this for me needlessly keeps me in the audience, I think, at arm's length from a character in a portrait that's ultimately about empathy and would be very easy to identify with. It's an orphan kid, basically.
Yeah, I thought that kid's performance was amazing.
He's terrific. I don't know why he goes for such an austere Bressonian, you know, kind of approach, but as austere Bressonian movies go, I'll take Paul Schrader's
I was about
first
to ask.
Any day. That movie began as, so Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver and, yeah, you know, directed American Gigolo and has done all of these kind of like high testosterone, you know, kind of angry man shaking his fist or shotgun at the world, you know, kind of movies, pulls back and makes a very restrained portrait, you know, Diary of a Country Priest style portrait starring Ethan Hawke. The movie's very formalist and restrained and allows, I think, a lot of room to engage with its spiritual dimension.
Yeah, I agree.
And then it goes bananas in a way that I still haven't sorted out. You know, it's like, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it becomes a proper Paul Schrader movie in the latter stretch. And
It does wander into Travis Bickletown, but in a way that's still in keeping with what the rest of the film has been like.
Right. I mean, I don't necessarily buy the premise that a you know, priest would somehow be converted to potentially becoming like an eco-terrorist. But if you do go along with that, you know, that notion, then the final act of the movie is just kind of this, you know, all of that restraint that we've seen bursts free and you know, kind of gives you the catharsis you may have been wanting.
Yeah. Cool. All right.
Sverrir Gudnason. That's Bjorn Borg's name.
Right.
That's the actor.
What else has he been in? Anything that we were seeing?
When I looked him up, all of his other things like look really kind of like, you know, unshaven and kind of like, you know,
right. Sketchy.
Whereas here he just plays this kind of Greek god I mean, he's playing the opposite of McEnroe, which is in this case kind of like someone who's almost robotic.
Right.
You know. The thing that the movie comes up with as a conceit is that the two of them are kind of like, you know, two sides of the same coin, except one has learned to internalize all of his aggression and, you know, kind of like and anger, and the other, you know, sort of like
exploding id.
Right. And yet, you know, the twist, which I think people know, is that they became friends.
Right.
And so if you look at the entire movie as this, you know, strange preamble to their friendship based on this, you know, fact that they're matched against one another. And I mean, I would like to go see the movie a second time because I know so little about tennis and didn't know that going in, just to study the way that they're...
It's funny, I, you know, like as a kid, I was never super into sports, but there were certain things that my family would always watch, and I would just sort of be in the room when that was happening, and one of them was Wimbledon. And I distinctly remember the Borg-McEnroe matches, because they were fascinating, because McEnroe was such a loose cannon, and you never knew when he was just going to, like, have some tantrum on the court and start yelling at the refs and all that stuff, and Borg was such a cool customer. I have a very distinct memory of watching this. I mean, like, I remember the Billie Jean King Bobby Riggs thing happening, but I was very young, and I don't know that I ever watched the actual game, but I totally remember Borg McEnroe.
You know, the movie reminds me a little bit of Ron Howard's movie Rush.
Oh, yeah.
You know, from a few years back, I mean, again, it's like, I don't care a lick about Formula One.
Yeah.
And yet, a movie like that, or these, you know, kind of like just totally wins me over to the subject.
I love sports movies so much more than I like sports.
Right.
You know, because you get all the drama. You get all the things that people wait around entire seasons for. In a 90-minute, you know, compression.
You know, people who like sports can't abide sports dramas because, you know, the whole chance of it all has been stripped away.
It's nothing but highlights.
Right. But, so there are a couple other movies worth throwing out there just from Toronto that were, you know, breakouts. One is the Tanya Harding kind of mock documentary, Tanya.
Margot Robbie, right?
She's fantastic, you know. And the whole movie, I tend to get kind of a bad taste when it's a movie about the, you know, the criminal or the assassin versus the victim, you know. It's like but in a really fascinating way, this movie makes a case early on that, you know, Tanya Harding is a victim of her own, and while it doesn't justify, you know, the, you know, sort of hobbling of Nancy Kerrigan, it does give a rich kind of dimension to explore that, you know, she's kind of, you know, self-described in the film as white trash. She, you know, is kind of not someone that the institution of figure skating would ever invite into its ranks. You know,
right.
It's like there's a whole class thing, a whole comportment, you know, dimension. And also, you know, just this kind of like culture of abuse, which was a recurring theme at the fall festivals this year. You know, the film that won kind of like the first time filmmaker award at Venice, Custody, which I think is a filmmaker really to be watched. Xavier Legrand, did this movie Custody, is all about that, you know, based on an extension of an Oscar nominated short on the same subject.
I hear Allison Janney is really good in I, Tonya, too.
And Allison Janney plays, you know, sort
of mom.
Her abusive mother, you know, before she sort of hooks up with this, you know, knucklehead abusive boyfriend. But like Allison Janney's phenomenal in it. Mm. And I mean, I've loved her in so many things, including recently on 6 Degrees of Separation on the New York stage. You know, it's like great, but you know, this is something where there's a funny moment kind of midway through the movie where she kind of like, they're playing with this conceit of, you know, fake interviews and each of the characters, but based on actual footage, she does, you know, her interviews with a parakeet on her shoulder, chain smoking.
You know? I'm wondering if that footage comes from our friend Sandra Lukow, who's a documentarian, early on did a short doc about Tonya Harding before all the Nancy Kerrigan stuff happened.
Oh,
like
weird.
She came early to that one. I don't remember how she knew her, how she knew that world. Maybe she was also a figure skater. Sandra's fascinating. She's also a ventriloquist. She did an entire feature doc about ventriloquism that screened at Sundance. But yeah, she just sort of remastered or something because of this movie coming out, like that she, you know, she did the original Tonya movie.
I mean, I wonder if that's where that footage comes, because you see it sort of matched up at the end to remind you that they're not
over the
giving her a random
funny
prop, but she kind of like, you know, elbows in like, you know, 2/3 of the way through the movie to be like, you know, wait a minute, like, you guys haven't forgotten me, have you? Where am I in this? You know, the movie is, you know, such a smart and, you know, kind of like really lively, you know, recreation of this true crime scenario, which is, you know, one of the favorite genres of we Americans. You know, we create such ridiculous true crimes that they make much better movies than
fictional,
you know, than fictionalized ones. The director, Craig Gillespie, did Lars and the Real Girl and, you know, has done a number of Hollywood films and has the real polish to deliver this, you know, the absurdity of this movie, which has kind of a Fargo-esque element to it in some ways.
I can see that.
I mean, the regional kind of caricature and I think that movie was picked up by Neon and it doesn't have a release date yet.
No, actually, I read yesterday it's opening either early November or early December, but it is coming out before the end of the year.
Well, great.
Awards pushing it.
Was sort of where I was going with this is that, like, I mean, I think it's, there's enough of a cause to really take this performance seriously that I expect it would kind of land on the calendar before the end of the year.
Cool.
And then the other one that I just flipped for, you know, right now is kind of shot to the head of my favorite, you know, list of favorites of the year is 3 Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, okay.
Which, did you see it at Venice?
It also screened after I left, unfortunately. So, but yeah, I'm dying to see the new Martin McDonagh.
That's right. I mean, it's terrific. And it is sort of like the yin to Fargo's yang in that, it is a regional movie. It stars
Francis McDormand.
You know, it's like, there is, you know, there is an investigation into a crime here, but she's not the law in this case. She's like a, you know,
the grieved party.
Right. And I expected, based on the premise, that this, you know, this woman whose daughter was raped and murdered and who rents 3 billboards on kind of a back road into town to kind of call out the local police chief for not solving the crime. The case has kind of gone cold. You know, I assumed it would be a more traditional whodunit, but in a really fascinating way, it's almost more like a projection of her own conscience. You know, whatever role she played in, you know, or guilt she feels for this, you know, crime and the loss of her daughter and this, you know, the kind of strained relationship they had, you know, she's kind of like trying to wash. And it just becomes much more interesting as it plays off of that and all sorts of other, I think, things that are kind of in the ether right now about. This movie has maybe one of the most eloquent indictments of the Catholic Church I've ever seen in a movie, where she likens it to a gang and says that, you know, it's like, In the same way that you can see the monologue in the movie when it comes time, but like she's basically saying that, you know, all priests are complicit in the cover up of these crimes. And it's the kind of thing where the audience burst into applause. The audience awarded this film the audience prize Toronto, by the way.
Which has been another sort of best picture barometer of late.
Right, yeah, like a bellwether for the, you know, for the best picture a lot of times. You know, even movies like 12 Years a Slave that do not strike anyone as an audience pleasing film have won and gone on.
Yeah, Slumdog Millionaire, yeah.
I mean, there are big questions as to exactly how the... who, like, does the audience pick that award, or does someone behind the scenes just anoint a film? But it doesn't matter. Like, but in a film that kind of has this, you know, attack on the Catholic Church among its many kind of prickly, you know, satirical edges, it all builds to this kind of really eloquent statement on forgiveness and among different characters. And I found that to be the thing that the real soul of that movie.
All right, cool. Looking forward to that one, which is also opening for the end of the year, obviously, for awards consideration. So,
not only is she great, another supporting performance in that movie, Sam Rockwell, as good as I've ever seen him. Plays the kind of, you know, Dingus McGee, you know, like deputy or whatever. You know,
Dingus McGee is my cousin. So, have you know.
You'll be the best judge of how well he captures that. Woody Harrelson is pretty great as the chief. That's kind of the focus of all of this. But like Sam Rockwell's character somehow takes it the most personally and sort of just makes everything, escalates everything in a way that really cooks the pot. You know,
cool. But, so the big movie of the weekend is Kingsman: The Golden Circle.
Yeah.
But the movie that we're most interested in this weekend is Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, which opened last week in New York but finally opened in L.A. this weekend.
Which one would you like to talk about first?
Let's talk about Ex Libris.
Okay.
It runs like a fleet 199 minutes or something.
Yes. Zipped right by.
Three and a half hours.
I've now seen it twice.
Really?
Yeah, because I saw it in Venice.
I didn't realize. I refer to this kind of behavior as cinemasochism. You know, it's like, there's clearly, like, you know, much pleasure being taken if you went around for round two.
Yeah, no, and actually, there were things I picked up on this time that I didn't, you know, because it was also like I saw it at the end of a full day at Venice. So
it was sort of
good to be fresher.
Semi-lucid.
So this is the latest Frederick Wiseman film. If you were a top level member of our Patreon subscription at patreon.com/linoleumknife, you would have received a copy of Wiseman's The Store and had a
last year
chatty discussion with us about it on Google Hangout
in 2016.
Wiseman won an honorary Oscar last year,
I believe. You're right.
Yeah.
And
after a career of never getting nominated for Best Documentary,
and he
shockingly,
also, you know, was awarded by us, the LA Film Critics, a Lifetime Achievement Award a couple years back.
Yeah. He is one of the great American documentary filmmakers, going all the way back to his controversial and once banned Titicut Follies, which was about the horrifying behind the scenes at a mental hospital in New England.
Like a short film. Not by Wiseman standards, at like whatever it is, 80 minutes, 65
minutes? Yeah, rather brisk, because he definitely likes his real estate. He'll make a 3-4-5 hour documentary about like a small town in Maine, or about public housing, or a hospital, or a hospice, or a department store, or the Ballet Russe, or the Crazy Horse, or the National Gallery.
I want to say that Near Death is the long.
That's the hospice
it's
one.
6 hours, and it takes place in a hospital, but in the hospice
wing.
You know, it might be worth interjecting on it. I don't know if it's useful or not, but like at the Telluride Film Festival, if I were going on my own, you know, resources, I would skip all those movies that will be coming out in the coming months and running for Oscar.
Right.
Go
and
to
focus
the
on the other half of the lineup, which this year included the director's cut of Francis Ford Coppola's The Cotton Club.
Oh, cannot wait to see.
And who knows how he will ever... that was the rights and, you know, financiers of that movie were epically...
complicated.
Know, kind of complicated back in the day. That I managed to catch as my last film there. But on the first evening... They invited Joshua Oppenheimer, whose Act of Killing world premiered there several years ago, to choose half a dozen movies, and Titicut Follies was one of those, which I, you know, is maybe the Wiseman film I've most wanted to see over these years, and I just couldn't, you know, justify it when I should be reviewing other films. But one of these today was the first time I've made it through an entire Frederick Wiseman movie, which is I feel ashamed that it has taken me this long. I've made it through many halves of his movies, but
What stopped you at half with the other films?
Well, I think it is that I know how I am when I'm home viewing, and I don't think that his movies would hold up well to the, you know, distraction of multitasking that I tend to do at home. Oh, and they're so seldom, you know, shown. They're very brief runs, if ever, in, you know.
Well, they've been doing these retrospectives, like last year in New York and then here in Los Angeles at CineFamily. They did the first, third of his career?
I think maybe the first quarter.
Okay, yeah. And so they did Titicat Follies, Hospital, High School, a lot of the really early ones.
Law and Order.
And then this fall, I don't know where, since CineFamily is currently not open. I'm hoping somebody else picks up on it, whether it's LACMA or, you know.
That'd be a good, Hammer Museum.
The Hammer could do it.
Sure. But there's a touring thing now of a complete retrospective. So whatever the second chunk of it will be happening this fall, so you will have other opportunities to see.
And
this
what I will often do is, if there is National Gallery, I saw half of it. It's hard when you're at a film festival on the trade review beat to see any film that you're not reviewing.
Sure.
You know, because the demand's just to sort of see and turn around reviews immediately of these things.
Yeah.
And so it's a real luxury to have, you know, 2 hours, much less four, to spare. But the last few I've seen fractions of, just out of curiosity, to kind of give me a sense of what they are. And strangely enough, I feel like after today's, you know, why does it stop after 3.5 hours? It could be, I was, sort of describing the experiences. It's not structured in some sort of traditional, what we're going to get to or some point we're going to reach. It's like a string of pearls where these scenes are kind of, little treasures unto their own. Mm-hmm. And there's an indefinite number of them. And the last one is
the last one.
Yeah, the movie's kind of they stop rather than end. I totally agree. But the thing to know about Wiseman, if you've never seen one of his movies, is that he is the kind of documentarian who doesn't overtly seem to be managing the content, in terms of there is no music, there is no voiceover, there are no two camera interviews, there are no identifying chyrons on screen when people are talking. Right. Nothing like that. Long takes, long still shots. And so it's very immersive. It's very, fly on the wall. But it's not, any kind of manipulation or commentary is happening in the editing, because
which he certainly does. So,
there's no such thing as a purely objective filmmaking, and certainly not purely objective documentary filmmaking. But he doesn't overtly nudge you in a direction the way when Michael Moore comes on screen and tells you exactly what he thinks about a thing. It's the opposite of that.
Well, and it's incredible that over the course of a career he's been so consistent in his attention to institutions and bureaucracy and process and, infrastructure that of the modern world, that he has built this body of work that is among the most valuable archives of 20th and 21st century life, I think.
Yes.
It reminds me of the one time that I got to meet Peter Greenaway. We brought him to Dallas at my old film festival when Pillow Book came out, and he was sort of touring the country and going around to different festivals, and he started at ours. And the thing that I found out later that people were telling me at the reception was that he was talking to everybody, but he wanted to know, what do you do? And what does that entail? And how does that work? And what are the pieces that, he was most interested in talking to whoever, but finding out what their specifics were. It's so much what Wiseman does, where it's you go to the National Gallery, he'll go to this, French strip club or whatever. And while he will certainly show you the outward facing aspects of it, you get so much time behind the scenes, and who's making these decisions, and how are those decisions made, and who decides and why. The complaint I've heard from people about this movie is the meetings. There's so many conferences, there's so many sort of meetings about this stuff, and it's
who complained?
I've seen some folks online bringing it up. And
there was a lot of that in National Gallery as well. At least, you know, the first eight hours of it that I watched.
The store does it too. You know, you do get, I mean, not as much in the store, but you do get some of these meetings behind the scenes of like the decision about what gets displayed and how are we moving this product and, you know, that kind of thing. And just for me, as somebody who's worked at a nonprofit, like I've been in those meetings. I know those meetings, and I know that it takes a million of those meetings for the public facing thing to even happen.
Right.
You know, you go to a film festival and there's a party and here's the screening and here's this other thing. And you know, I'm going to meet these guys. All of that was the result of meeting after meeting after meeting. And there's one woman in this film. I don't know her name because they don't identify anybody. Blonde lady with a bunch of different eyeglasses. She's a hero because she can talk to the money people. She can talk to the other sort of like staff people. She can talk to the on the ground librarians and like understand what they're talking about and, you know, keep people enthusiastic and keep people on focus. And, you know, when she can boil down the big sort of like airy fairy concepts of like the big picture things into actual, you know, action points and things that can be done and what those steps are. And it's like, and every nonprofit has to have at least one of those people.
Well, and I think anybody who's had to sit through that kind of thing at work, you know, is not running to the movie theater to experience
maybe,
it. And yet, in terms of this kind of like time capsule, you know, artifact of our era kind of thing, that is essential material to capture.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, it's, there's a lesson, and I think, you know, these movies must sound boring to people on paper, you know, long, you know, movies about process, but or infrastructure, you know, but like, I think the lesson is, you know, that when a filmmaker himself is so inherently interested in his subject, that's how a 3.5-hour movie becomes captivating to an audience, you know, and it's the lesson of a movie like Boyhood, which is not traditionally, you know, kind of narrative. It's more episodic or more anecdotal. And, you know, it's like just I think the sensibility that Linklater brings, the curiosity he has about his characters and his natural humanism, all of that is like contagious. And, you know, those are the kind of things that, you know, it's impossible to know until you're in the hands of a filmmaker. And you may know within the first 10 minutes that this person doesn't have that. I mean, it's certainly, you know, something that I think, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, a Michael Bay lacks. I mean, the characters are beside the point in his movie.
Right.
You know,
and they're just as long.
Right.
and unless, you know, people are, you know, thinking that this is all a movie about, you know, committee meetings and trustee meetings. It's not.
No.
You know,
you get to see old people do aerobics.
You see everything that the New York Public Library does throughout the city. All the programs, the after-school homework programs, the
job fairs,
the old people aerobics class, the job fairs, the, you know, the famous people who come and have the, you know, in conversation with Patti Smith and Elvis Costello, you know, like that sort of thing.
You know, the branch that's all Braille and audiobook for blind people, and you get to see like how Braille stuff gets put together, how those audiobooks are recorded. I posted on Facebook that I was seeing this movie again, and somebody said that distribution center scene could have been twice as long.
Oh yeah,
there's just amazing scene where like all the books are in this central location, just people putting them on these conveyor belts. They get scanned, and then the belt just shoots them off into the right branch.
You want that music? Yeah. You want that music to be playing?
No, I love that scene, and it's like because it's like you get to see behind the scenes, but all of this is behind the scenes. And there's a woman, you know, who appears as a guest at some panel or presentation, you know, being asked about the future of libraries. But she defines the present of libraries as it is not just a repository for books, which for those of us who think about libraries to the extent that we think about libraries at all, you know, it's like that tends to be what we think of them as. And
she says, no, it's a place where people go to get knowledge.
Right, right, right. And like, and we're at a moment where that is all changing. It's going digital. And even as it goes digital and you may no longer need a place to hold your books, it is still about how, you know, the public has access to that stuff and to the culture behind it. And,
you see them like checking out little sort of mini Wi-Fi things to people because apparently
for a year
at a time. Because according to them, 1 in 3 New Yorkers don't have access to the internet.
Right.
You know, and so if everything is going digital, then who gets to have that information and how do they access it? And so
that was one of my favorite moments because when she hands them the little box, she says, "Congratulations."
Well, yeah, because I'm sure it's like tough to get into that program.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have no fines on your card. I think on the micro level, this is about the library and how it works. And there is a definite time capsule quality that will make this movie eternally interesting. But I think in the macro, when you look at how degraded the idea of facts have become, mm-hmm. you know, and truth and science and all that other stuff that we've taken for granted for so long, all the more important now. And this is a movie that was shot in 2015, so before, you know, the current era we're in, but obviously we've been sliding down there for a long time. You know, the idea of knowledge and facts and access to those facts and digging for them, you know, toward the end of the film, somebody says truth is complicated. And yeah, it is complicated. And if you want to find the truth, you have to dig for it. And if you want to dig for it, you have to have a library.
Yeah. For me personally, I think of this in the way that I think of National Gallery, but also in the way that I think of In Jackson Heights, the two more recent
mm-hmm.
Films, because his films tend to be split up into institutions and communities. And when the institution is itself, you know, a microcosm of the community,
right,
then he's got that rare, you know, hybrid
jackpot
film. And that's what this is, because National Gallery was very much in the building.
Yeah.
You know, and this is about everything that happens outside of the building as well as in the building.
Yeah, you start
all the little satellite buildings. In fact, one of my favorite parts, your hero of the movie is the blonde lady. Mine is the black lady with the short haircut and the necktie and
yes.
the perfect skin. Like Fenty Beauty needs to be calling her for an ad campaign. You could feel her absolute dominion over this branch, and how she was
in
like,
Harlem, yeah.
This is the best branch. We all know that.
We're the jewel of the New York Public
Library system. We're the jewel, and she just held that meeting of folks, so I love this movie. I knew I would love it going in because I love his films, and I love libraries. And one of the things I truly think as I watched it was, what happens if the bad people stay in power? You know, by the way, currently it's September of 2017 and the bad people are in power.
Yes.
Just in case you're listening to this
years later,
a year, three,
we are
five
making
later.
Time capsules. Hey,
there you go.
The bad people stay in power, and the funding concerns they kept talking about again and again and again and again.
Again, if you've ever worked for a nonprofit, this is always the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we didn't have libraries already as mm-hmm. an institution in the world, but in particular as an institution in the United States, if we didn't have them, and someone came up to you today and said, "I've got this great idea. Libraries." Some a-hole would say that's socialism.
Exactly.
Because that's what they are.
Yeah.
And
just like fire departments,
for example. And so I'm so very happy that we have this document now.
Yeah.
Because in the future, dystopia, when there aren't any more, we can say this is what we used to have.
Mm.
Well, you know that librarian
that's being pessimistic, but
that you're talking about, and I mean, one of the many subtexts or texts of this film is race relations and mm-hmm. that. I mean, like they spend a lot of time looking at the Schoenberg Center.
Right.
It celebrates its 90th anniversary during the course of it, and that is, you know, an archive of race related documents, and you know the, but also when you think about who uses libraries. And there's even a scene where they talk about kind of like the rule of how, you know, they deal with homeless people who come in and they're allowed to be there but not to sleep there and things
right,
like that.
Right.
But, I mean, when you think about the fact that it tends to be, you know, a place where lower class people can have access to things and more selectively, I think, you know, rich folks or artists or whatever might, you know, researchers might, you know, draw from it, but right. on a day in, day out basis. And then there's the meta question of, well, how representative is a library of the society as a whole or those groups or those, you know, different races and whatnot.
Because it's a public space.
Right. And I think that, you know, the New York Public Library is very engaged with that question and obviously has been for 90 plus years, dating yeah. back to when, you know, Carnegie as kind of like this figurehead that they keep referencing, you know, set the kind of mandate that everyone have a library within walking distance of his home. And, you know, the was the one who acquired that collection and others, you know, but I mean, there are just all these fascinating aspects that Weissman doesn't put his finger on, but just by virtue of the sheer volume of the running time that is dedicated, I think, to questions of race and race history.
Totally, yeah, yeah.
You know, and again, that, you know, that Harlem-based library, is it Harlem or the Bronx? I can't remember.
It was the Harlem, the something right. bridge.
Yeah.
Because Brooklyn and Queens, remember, those are sister systems. You can't return your books there.
Right, exactly. it's just fascinating how much you learn from a movie about libraries.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, like, I know, again, the idea of a three-hour-plus documentary sounds daunting, but there's more life in this movie than almost anything I've seen all year. You know, it just, the sense of humanity and the sense of just people, just a vitality of people existing and being interesting and wanting to know things and, you know, just being part of a recognizable world and a community. It's thrilling.
Well, and also they're just the colorful characters around that, you know, the guy who with a magic marker colors his mustache in Bryant Park behind
yeah
you know, the Grand Central
was that
branch.
A magic marker or an eyebrow pencil? I couldn't
it might
tell.
Have been that, yeah.
It looked like a Sharpie. I saw it happen, and it's that weird thing.
It's a
you think,
quick shot.
Wait, did he just do like yeah.
I do wish that Weissman spent more time people watching and less time people listening. He's really interested in these discourses, which
right.
sometimes kind of make my eyes glaze over. And he will, within that, do these really quick, rapidly edited, sort of, he'll circulate through the crowd. And it's like, I could spend the whole time watching the crowd.
You know? Yeah, it is interesting how, like, and sometimes, even when you're hearing something that's interesting, like the guy talking about the history of Jewish delis in New York, you know, after World War I, like they'll cut to audience members and they just seem to be like half nodding off or something. And it's kind of like,
and it's clearly not synced either. That, I mean, he cheats as a documentary editor uh-huh. in terms of, you know, the way that he will, it's not that he has multiple cameras, or if he does, it's not like he's matching something to the exact time.
Necessarily, so there,
it sometimes reads strangely, but, yeah. the, I mean, that's a quibble. how much longer would the movie be if it were?
You know? All right, Kingsman.
Kingsman.
I did not see it, and I'm so happy. So go.
I didn't like the first one, and I didn't like this one. Are you a fan of either or both? Or
you know, I'm not a fan of the first one, but like there were things I appreciated about it. That you just had a hot British, you know, young scally kid turned spy, you know, and it's like the and you know the it, he was super handsome in the first one and shirtless often, and you know there were certain you know qualities, but
it's true he was shirtless often in the first one. Yeah.
I mean, there's like whereas this one is just ridiculous.
It's kind of plotting, yeah. So basically, what happens is Eggsy is back. He's still at Kingsman. The princess that he saves and who offers him anal sex in the first film, they're now living together. And a thing happens and almost everybody from Kingsman gets wiped out. But Eggsy and the Mark Strong character discover that they have an American counterpart called Statesman. And that they operate behind the front company of a whiskey distillery. So off they go to Kentucky, where they find Channing Tatum and Halle Berry and Jeff Bridges, and they all combine so they can take down Julianne Moore, who plays a drug kingpin who has released this poisoned supply that is killing people, and she tries to make a deal with the U.S. president that she'll give them the antidote, but only if they end the war on drugs and legalize everything. So the first movie was about a bad guy trying to end global warming by killing off most of the planet, and this one is about a drug kingpin trying to end the drug war on drugs by threatening to kill a bunch of people. So
not only like killing all of her clients, it makes no sense.
So these movies are like so right wing in like cutesy, you know, sheep's clothing. It's really annoying. And Julianne Moore, bless her heart, as I said on What the Flick, she's winking so hard she bruised an eyeball. Whereas Glenn Kenny said all they got from her was a passing Megan Mullally impersonation.
Sort of,
like,
yeah.
She's camping it up real hard, and it's not fun to watch. Yeah, and so, yeah, the first movie we get the anal sex joke. This movie we get a hidden camera...
It's like a GPS tracking device that needs to be inserted into a mucus membrane. We'll pick which one that might be. You know,
I mean, I get, you know, like the placement was consensual, but the fact that there was an object involved was not, and so it's just like, you know, Mark Miller. I'm sorry, enough already. I liked the first Kick-Ass, but just like the second one got really sour.
Matthew Vaughn, you mean?
Mark Miller's the guy whose comics these are based on.
Oh, sorry.
Matthew Vaughn. Okay. Yeah, together. They both need to knock it off. and yeah, these Kingsman movies, I just like, yeah, you're right. The first one had some fun, kind of like over-the-top spy stuff. This time, it's overstuffed with characters. Like I saw with Robert Abel, he's like, this is like the Cannonball Run 2.
Not only that, but they resurrect two characters who died in the first movie.
Yeah.
It's like as if you don't have enough other, you know, kind of like...
Exactly. And look, everybody knows they resurrect Colin Firth because it's on the billboard.
Right.
Which the director apparently was mad about that.
To cover up his, like, you know...
Getting shot in the head in the first one.
Right.
But also, like, the action's not all that great in this one. In fact, there are moments, especially, like, in that first scene where Eggsy's in the, like, car chase and stuff, the green screen is so bad, you can pretty much see an aura around him. You know, that's like Dean Jones in an old Disney movie or something. So it was all so kind of fakey CG, no stakes, no weight. I didn't care about any of it.
And I mean, to call what Elton John does an extended cameo, I mean, he's basically a leading character. He gets so much
screen
time. It makes no sense. He's basically like, you know, he is also somehow under the drug-influenced poison of...
Right, well, she has kidnapped... She, you know, this Julianne Moore is so rich and powerful that even though her hideout is in the Cambodian jungle, she has turned it into, like, this mini sort of fake 50s town with, like, a diner and a beauty parlor and a theater where she has kidnapped Elton John and forces him to perform for her every night. He's kind of whatever. He has a few funny moments where he sort of just is flagrantly mugging at the camera during like a really absurd moment, but like a little of that goes a long way.
I mean, it's weird to criticize a performance of someone playing himself, and yet like he seems to be overdoing it.
Exactly. It's like Truman Capote in Murder by Death. So I'm done with these, you know. People love them for some reason. Like, I get more crap online about not liking these movies. And even people whose taste I generally respect, like, what? It was fun. Like,
well, I mean, I think there are people who, it's more than like a suspension of disbelief. It's like, you know, never having understood the concept of belief to begin with. I mean, like, you just check out, you know, kind of like going in, but... there are people who I think are on its wavelength.
I guess. I mean, and look, I would be willing to like throw everything out the window if it were fun and, you know, I was amused or charmed or, you know, thrilled by what was going on. But I just find it all kind of smarmy and dumb.
And for me, like, as someone who recognizes the talent, the potential that Matthew Vaughn has and like has brought to Layer Cake or especially Stardust, which I think is an underrated, you know, but maybe overly extravagant movie. You know, it's like I just kind of want to see him find the groove where we were kind of in sync together again. But
did he do X-Men First Class?
That sounds plausible.
I'm thinking
I think so.
Yeah. I'm not the go-to source on superhero.
Yeah, I didn't mind trivia. X-Men First Class. It was okay. All right, so whatever. This movie.
I'm so happy I missed it.
Lucky, lucky you.
Never do I gotta.
All right, Peter has to motor, so we're going to say goodbye to you now. But thank you for popping over and giving us the TIFF scoop.
It's been a delight, guys. Thanks. We should do this more often.
Yeah, come on back. All right, so thank you, Peter DeBruges, and we'll be right back. Ugh, thank God he's gone.
He's still sitting right here. Everyone can hear you. Not true. He's actually just walked out.
I waited for him to clear the building.
Well, that was a lovely... This has been a great day. Because I got to eat my lunch at Non Hut.
Mm-hmm.
Next to the Royal Theater. And then right. I got to see the Wiseman movie. Which just felt like luxury to me. And then after the movie, before we came home to do this podcast, I got to go back to Non Hut and get a big thing of sangak and all the dipping sauces.
It's been enjoyable. I just wish the churro...
Dinner from Non Hut, lunch from Non Hut, 3.5 hour Wiseman movie.
I wish the churros place next to the Royal didn't have such weird hours.
Y'all know the recipe to making me happy. I just
Starch
told you what,
undocumented.
Just told you what it was.
What was I going to tell you? About the Non-Hut and the other thing and the thing, the what? I've forgotten now. I don't know.
Okay, so now everyone is going to shut up and listen to me talk about Woodshock. And that's kidding. You've seen Woodshock.
I have, but you should take the lead here.
Woodshock is the first feature from Kate and Laura Malevi. Together, they are the sisters behind the fashion label Rodarte. And I have been a Rodarte fan for years now. I remember seeing their clothing in magazines and thinking, what is that she's wearing?
For new listeners, Dave, despite outward appearances, is very interested in fashion.
Women's fashion.
Women's fashion.
I'm interested in women's fashion. Men's clothing is not interesting to me.
No, it's boring.
Men's wear, particularly sort of forward-thinking men's wear, because I do have a dog in that hunt, when I see it, I think, nope. That's not ever a thing I'm going to put on myself. You might occasionally get me to like, you know, well, it's moot because I can't fit into any of it. But the, because I'm a fatty, but.
You're not ordering a romp him?
But when I see, no, that's not what I'm even talking about. When I see someone, when I see a designer like Walter Van Beerendonk.
Yes.
Make clothes that look like they are for space aliens.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I think, okay, now that is cool. Like, I'm down for that. I'm never wearing it.
Right.
A, because I'm a fatty, but B, just because I don't wear space alien things. I like to wear clothes that make me invisible and nondescript.
Yeah, you are Coco Chanel. You have your uniform.
I don't want...
Utilitarian
outfit. I don't want to be noticed. And recently, this is a digression, by the way, the reason you listen to this show. Recently, I've had the experience of being out in public while wearing shirts that have buttons in the front and long sleeves. You know, a grown-up person's shirt. And that shirt could be wrinkled. It could be old and fraying. I could be wearing it untucked. And invariably, someone says to me, why are you dressed up?
And
why'd you get all dressed
and
up?
And why is that, Dave?
Because it's a shirt with buttons on it and because my uniform is...
T-shirt.
Black t-shirt, 501s, or a pair of Dickies.
Mm-hmm.
Those Dickies work pants. And either a pair of sneakers or those black Red Wing boots. That is essentially my uniform.
Right. So if you never wear a button-down shirt and then you wear a button-down shirt, people notice.
I understand that. But what I realized about that moment was, those times when it has happened to me in the past year, is that I am being noticed. I am being noticed for that consistency.
Right.
And so what I have to do now to become anonymous again...
Is mix it up.
Is mix it up. So no one is thinking about me at all. No one is thinking about me being having a uniform on of any sort. No one is thinking about it.
Well, or you need to go full Einstein and just like have the same, wear the same stuff all the time. And then if you never deviate from it, then no one's thinking about it at all.
But you can't never deviate from it. You know, there's going to be an occasion where you have to dress a little better than normal.
Well, I'm not
there's
saying...
There's going to be an occasion where all your T-shirts are dirty and the only shirt clean is the one of the three shirts you own that have buttons
right,
on.
But you could up your basic game.
Well, that's what's been happening. I've been doing that. Anyway, that's a little story about me.
I'm just saying, for people, you know your stuff when it comes to the Rodarte line.
Where I was going with this was, yes, women's fashion, endlessly fascinating to me. And I'm not by any means a fashion writer, but I have written about fashion for various, you know, websites and magazines in the past, not so much now.
Didn't you write about a Rodarte exhibition or something for our friend Graham's old blog?
I did, yeah. And because their clothes often wind up in museums, and that's one of the things that is fascinating to me about them is that their clothes are so weird and so art referential that I am actually sort of surprised that they've become popular, and they have become really popular.
Did they do like a Target line or something?
They have done a Target line.
Well, there you go.
Don't you remember the day that came out? Shannon Lee Old said, "Come with me to Target.
Oh, that's
I'm buying
right.
one of everything."
I do remember that now. Yes, and you went with her.
And I was like, "I'll do that. I'll go with you. That'll be fun." So, so I'm such a fan that you know, I know what they look like. And they live in Los Angeles.
Right.
And it became a thing and has become a thing in my life. And this is completely coincidental, but
they're accidental stalker.
No, they are accidentally stalking me.
Ah, okay, you're right.
Because everywhere I go,
There they are.
Always together. Like, just like there were never such devoted sisters. Bookstores, art galleries, restaurants. That night we were out eating out.
At Lou,
went back when Lou had the restaurant. Yeah. And they walked in with Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah.
And you were like, ooh, Kirsten Dunst. And I was like, ooh, the Rodarte girls are here. Again. Following me everywhere I go.
One of these days, y'all are going to meet.
No, it's not happening now because I've reviewed their film and we can't be friends now. They're going to hate me.
You wrote the nicest review of their movie. Relatively speaking, you wrote the rave of their movie.
No, I don't believe. Okay, so here's what the film is about. Kirsten Dunst plays a woman who lives in Northern California. It was shot in Humboldt County in Eureka, which is where all the
redwoods and the weed are.
What few redwood trees California has left are there.
Yeah. I would like to go there sometime.
That's one of the themes of the film, actually. She works in a medical marijuana dispensary. And the film opens with her assisting her terminally ill mother to death.
Yes.
She does so by rolling her mom a joint with a mysterious toxic liquid that she has used to soak the weed in. You never find out what this liquid is, but it plays a role in the film.
It's like the orange powder that Jennifer Lawrence uses in Mother.
Yeah,
we don't know what it is.
The tincture.
This
sequence is juxtaposed with shots of Kirsten Dunst walking among the redwoods among these huge redwood stumps.
Yeah.
Dead trees.
Felled.
And it reminded me immediately of Barbara Loden's 1970 film, Wanda, which begins with a woman in a miserable domestic situation. And the next shot, it's Wanda. The next shot is Wanda walking through this just decimated, just blackened coal site in eastern Pennsylvania. And when I saw Kirsten Dunst so tiny against these redwoods and these stumps, my first thought was, oh, in Wanda, they do the same thing where she's walking. She's wearing white pants and a white shirt. Just this little white speck of her walking next to this coal dirt. Yeah. And this is very much in keeping with what I already know of the Malivis and how they work with clothing. Their clothing is often very, very art referential, and they have a distinctly 70s vibe going on. So not only is their clothing avant-garde, but sometimes it also seems to be referencing like those gunny sacks dresses from the 70s. They'll use these really unusual materials and like modern fabrics that are metallic or shiny, but then there'll be these sort of grandma embellishments, embroidery, and things, little ribbons and laces and stuff, so that you're almost always confused at first by what it is you're seeing. And that is a lot of what goes down in this film.
Yeah, there's a lot of 70s flavoring going on, even though it's set in the modern day because of marijuana dispensaries.
Correct.
But all the guys have the kind of hipster hairdos where it could be 1973. You know.
It could be. So she's increasingly estranged from her boyfriend. She's having a rough relationship with her boss at the dispensary. There comes another terminally ill old man who needs the same assistance that her mother needed. And that goes terribly wrong. And I won't say how, but it just goes terribly wrong. And in Kirsten Dunst's grief and dismay and guilt for the things that have transpired, she takes that liquid. I'm thinking of the yellow liquid in the mother. She takes that mystery liquid,
yeah,
pours it on a bunch of joints,
mm-hmm,
and begins smoking them.
Right.
This begins the film's second half, which is almost entirely hallucination.
Yes.
Although there seem to be also sequences of things that are really happening to her as she is hallucinating.
Right.
Now, their influences, very much like with their clothes, are everywhere to be seen. And if you know their clothing work, and I'll tell you something I did before I watched this. I made sure, I went back and I watched the last three or four seasons of runway shows that they did.
Mm.
And they're all on YouTube. And I'm glad I did that because there are design elements that have carried over from their clothing line into this film. Lighting situations, musical cues. And I'll come back to this in a moment. But, you know, they thank Nan Golden in the credits, and she's this wonderful photographer who I love. She takes these very intimate portraits of her friends, and they're often very sorrowful. There's an artist named Gordon Matta Clark, who's no longer alive, but who spent a good part of his, you know, young career doing things like sawing an entire house in half. And so he is, not only is his cutout work referenced in their clothing a lot, but you get it back again in this film with, you know, there are these saws chopping down everything around her. You know, so much visual inspiration and art inspiration that goes into their work before this film has found its way into this film. So it's gorgeous. And I think that they are really onto something that hasn't quite coalesced yet.
That was my take also. I saw the film at Venice, and I don't have nearly the background of knowing about their fashion work or their influences. But I could tell that was, as much as this movie is a little too up its own ass for its own good, and a little, it gets lost in its sort of trippy hallucinations, there's a sense that they are capable of something a lot better, I think. There's a certain level of assuredness with certainly the visuals of the film.
Yes.
And with the performances of the film that I think if they can really nail down the narrative aspects or abandon them entirely.
The production design and the cinematography are impeccable. Yeah. And it doesn't matter what you're looking at because it's gorgeous.
Yeah, the production designer is the guy who did Her and a bunch of where the Wild Things Are. Like, he's done a lot of Spike Jones films.
They have mastered color and light and mood and texture and, you know, everything except emotion and finishing a movie. And I'll tell you something. I was watching one of the runway shows. And on one of the runway shows, the songs on this runway show are all very 1970s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the model, there's a couple models who come out in some outfits, and they're doing this as this early 70s pre-disco Bee Gees song. Mm-hmm. It's really emotional. Bee Gees song is playing.
Like I Started a Joke era?
Something like that, yeah. I don't remember the song. But I remember thinking, I'm feeling feelings now while I'm watching this runway show.
Which is more than you did in the movie.
I didn't feel feelings while I was watching this movie. And I know that this is a film about grief and guilt and despair. And I didn't get that. And I wanted that to get me the way they... I know they were trying to make that happen.
And I got looped in early on because I really like Kirsten Dunst and I really like Susan Trainor, who's the actress that plays her mother. Who's just one of those sort of like husky voiced character actresses that you see, you're like, oh yeah, her, you know, and you don't even remember what exactly you saw her in that you liked so much, but you just know that she's really good. And so there are these early moments, and because it's dealing with, you know, assisted suicide and all this stuff, where it's like, okay, there's some things happening here. And then things kind of stop happening, and that's where the movie sort of goes south. But I very much want them to make a second film. I want to see that second film.
As it moves toward its end, I felt them borrowing more and more from experimental cinema that, you know, things that you've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the quick cuts and the.
The layered sort of visuals.
Double exposures. Yeah. And I just don't... I am a fan. I'm a fan of these women. And I was so... We were all rooting for you. Tyra said.
And we also talked about, you know, the fact that it is one of those first films where people act like, I may never get to make another movie, so I'm going to throw every idea I ever had into this thing.
Everything in the movie at once. Yeah. I think people should see it.
Yes.
Because it looks so good and because it's grabbing for a thing that I don't think it quite grasps or gets. But I think they are really talented and really accomplished, and I want more from them.
Think of it as an installation more than a film. Maybe that'll make it more
sure.
More palatable.
Anyway,
it is definitely better than Friend Request.
Hang on, there's one more thing I want to say. I have
now always kill my segues.
Now that I've turned in my review to the Rab, I've gone and read some of the other reviews.
Uh huh.
Listen, fellow film critics. Tell all y'all something.
Is it the men especially or everybody?
It's kind of everybody.
Okay.
Fashion designers are also artists.
Yes.
And just because you think the fashion world is shallow doesn't mean you're right. And so when you throw words around in your reviews like dilettante, you are talking out of your ass, and you should be going back to school and learn about how talented and hardworking and thoughtful and intelligent the people who work in creating fashion really are. I want them to watch that scene with Meryl Streep explaining the blue
cerulean
to what's her face, to Anne Hathaway, because in that moment, that is everything that people who, because I'm not a fashion person,
yeah,
but I respect it.
Right.
And so, but often people who are not fashion people, they don't respect it. They think it's beneath them. They think it's silly. And they think anyone associated with it is automatically not serious.
Well, and also, did any of those people unpack those adjectives for a single man?
No, because a single man is actually pretty good.
Right, but I'm just saying, though, that guy, you know, Tom Ford...
But if it had not been pretty good...
They would have.
They would have.
I see.
Because okay. You know why? Because he's gay.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, dilettante.
Yeah.
Blech.
So, I'm... All of y'all, fellow film critics, you're all on notice.
On blast.
You don't have to like this movie, but you have to respect where these women are coming from.
Right.
Get out of my face. All of you.
So, yeah, friend request.
Blah. I would like to take a giant dump on this movie. If I had a physical, like, if they still sent out actual film prints... To movie theaters,
right?
That's I would like to have that. I would just be like, that's where my poop is going to go, on those canisters.
Ugh, 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 ugh. Okay, so
I can break it down.
Okay, go for it.
All right. So this terrible person, with a lot of Facebook friends,
is she terrible?
She's terrible,
or is she just basic?
Listen, every. Well, isn't that enough?
No, I think there's a difference between terrible and basic.
It's enough.
Fine.
She has a lot of Facebook friends. And all of her Facebook friends, and including her real life friends, they all do a lot of selfies.
Yes.
That's pretty much what they do. They mm-hmm. hang out and they take selfies.
Today's young people, Dave.
And so, no, it's not today's young people.
I'm kidding.
It's the garbage young people in this movie.
I'm kidding. But they show her doing charitable things, too, so you don't think she's a complete... She, like, interns at some kid's charity thing.
You know what? I just watched Shaw's of Sunset last week, and they all go to the L.A. Mission downtown the day before Thanksgiving.
Once a year.
Once a year for a photo op so they can, you know, serve food to the homeless. They do it for the TV show.
Yeah.
And... That's not the same thing
I see.
As being charitable. Okay, so she meets this goth girl who always wears a hoodie and has, you know, pale makeup on.
Circles under her eyes.
Dark circles under her eyes, and who seems kind of spooky, and who does some really dope animations on her Facebook wall, which in real life would get her a whole fan club of other goth people.
Yeah, but instead she has zero friends.
Zero. The letter. No, I'm sorry, the number. Zero. I don't know anything about numbers. The number is zero, and that means zero.
Yes.
Okay. So, boring, basic, terrible girl friends her. And then... does this as sort of like this weird sort of voyeuristic social experiment? Because she's sort of like, wow, I'm the only friend this person
she's
has.
She's trying to be That's nice, but like only nice and not an actual
friend. Not an
friend.
Actual friend, right. And so Spooky Girl, on her birthday, says, I can't wait to come to your birthday party. Meanwhile, Basic Terrible Girl is like, I didn't invite you to my birthday party. I mean, I'm not having a birthday party. Nothing. Nothing's happening. And then she can't even lie on the internet properly, and they go out to dinner with all the friends.
And they're all birthday cake. Taking pictures and tagging. It's like, do y'all not know anything about lying to somebody about your party?
Anybody, listen, I'm 53 years old. A 19-year-old knows the same thing that I know.
Yeah.
And they learned it before I learned it.
Yes.
Some nights, some events, some friend activities, you tell everybody in the room at once, you say, no social media. This dinner never happened. This house party never happened. This invite-only event where I only could invite 10 people It never happened.
This Game of Thrones themed orgy happened.
How many times have I done this with, not a Game of Thrones themed orgy, but how many times have I done this in our own life where I've said, okay, friends, we're doing a thing and no one is posting about it on any... If you're going to put that curtain up like you just did, could you like do it right? Because I can't look at it.
Well, I didn't do it all the way because I wanted to keep the sun out of your eyes.
I can't look at it. You've got it. It's all wrong. It's like the...
All right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Dave.
I can't see. Yeah.
No, you've done it many times.
I've done that many times. Sorry about the little interruption there. He wasn't doing it right. It's easy. It's easy. You tell the half a dozen or so or dozen people in the room, this is not happening.
Yeah.
And you don't, no one is, no photos, no tagging, no nothing. Because if you do...
The person that you lied to will invariably see it.
The person that you lied to about what you were doing that night, or the person that you like well enough...
But didn't invite.
But they aren't part of your inner circle of people, and you didn't invite them, you're going to hurt their feelings. Do you want to hurt everyone's feelings all the time? No, you're a nice person. You're a decent human being. And if we didn't live in the world of the internet, you could get away with all of this stuff, and it wouldn't even feel like a thing that you had to get away with.
Right.
It would just be life.
Yeah.
It would just be life the way it used to be. Oh, guess what? You weren't invited to a thing. Who cares? You didn't even know it happened.
I know. And the funny thing is, if I'm on the receiving end of that, if I see people I know at a thing and I was invited to it, I'd think...
Yeah,
I'm offended.
You're the first one who does it.
No. Yeah. I'm not offended they didn't invite me. I'm offended that they didn't hide it from me. it's like really? I didn't even rate a media blackout. You're just gonna flaunt this in front of me? That's what I get offended about.
I don't care. Seriously, we have friends who, if they have a birthday dinner. And they've invited like five other people and not us. I don't care.
Well, yeah, I'm not talking. I'm talking about larger events.
And I don't care if it goes out on social media. I don't care.
Fine.
Anyway, Terrible Girl is so stupid that she lies to Spooky Girl and then just doesn't follow through.
It doesn't cover her tracks. Gets it wrong.
So Spooky Girl commits suicide. And this is not a spoiler because it happens in the first scene of the movie.
Mind you, she commits suicide, and everyone says she commits suicide, but there's
never
no
found the body.
And
so what happens is, it turns out that she was brutally abused as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Also, she's a witch.
Yes.
Also, she's a demon. Yes. She has downloaded her witchy demon soul into Facebook.
Yes.
And has taken over Facebook, and is now controlling the Facebook wall of the Terrible Girl. And posting suicide videos to it.
Well, she's killing off Terrible Girl.
And then killing off Terrible Girl's friends simultaneously. And making
posting those videos too.
Posting those videos to Terrible Girl's Facebook wall. And so not only is Terrible Girl grieving the loss of her friends, but the film equates her diminishing Facebook numbers with
the deaths.
The actual deaths. Of the real people,
so yeah, like so, her friend number scrolls down, and we keep this pops up on screen periodically. Yeah,
the number of friends pops up on screen, and you see it going down. You're supposed to be,
oh no,
yeah, it's yeah. You're supposed to sit in the seat in your chair and be like, oh damn, everyone's dying, and she's less popular.
Now it would be great if this movie also like had a live interactive element where you could see its IMDb number scrolling downward in the corner of the film as well as more people see it.
It is, first of all, not only is it stupid, and not only is it taking itself seriously when it shouldn't, and then not taking itself seriously when it shouldn't.
Yeah, the comedy relief is so unfunny. That it's funny.
Yeah. And it's actually an immoral film. Because it's getting you to root against the person who was wronged.
The aggrieved party.
Yeah. And not just wronged, well, not just wronged by a terrible girl, but wronged her entire life.
Yeah. Yeah, because she was raised in a cult and then, like, abused. I mean, the one excuse for terrible girl is that the moment that she friends Spooky Girl goes all, like, single white female on her and is like, oh, we're best friends.
What, for like 3 days.
Yeah, exactly. What a terrible. I know. And that's supposed to count as being like, oh, well, yeah, then she should just die.
And if you were any kind of human being, you would say to the spooky girl, hey, you know, we don't
boundaries.
Really, we don't really know each other. And I need some space here. And,
that is not to say we can't become friends.
We can become friends. We could hang out maybe and see if we want to hang out again. And, you know, let's be reasonable like this. We're young adults and we're learning how to be reasonable.
But again, that 5-minute conversation would negate the entire movie.
The movie is too stupid to know how to navigate actual human being interactions.
Yeah.
It is laugh out loud funny in a number of spots.
It's true, yes. However, but not so much so that it's like you should go see it or anything.
You should not go see it in a movie theater. But when it streams.
Yeah, when it's on cable.
Have some drinks with some friends.
Yeah.
And then you might have a good time watching this awful, awful movie. It's not scary.
No.
Unless jump scares are your jam.
And even those aren't that good.
And they're not good.
I mean, the one thing it has going for it is that, like, there are a couple times where you think a jump scare is going to happen and it doesn't, but then the one that finally does happen isn't all that scary.
Right.
It's very restrained and PG-13 for an R-rated movie.
It really is. It's very weird. Like, they say the F word and that's kind of why it's R.
Pretty much. And I guess, like, the pregnant lady with weird sigils all over her or whatever. Ay, ay, ay. Also opening this weekend was Stronger, but we're going to wait and talk about that until Dave can see it. The new David Gordon Green movie with Jake Gyllenhaal about a true story about a guy who lost his legs in the Boston Marathon bombing.
So we're going to skip letters this week because our guest, Peter,
ate up so much time. what's your DVD pick this week?
Whenever we have a guest, I feel like we should go sort of longer with that guest.
Sure.
And I don't want to go super long.
Right.
And make it like a 2-hour episode.
You want to give them the time, but you don't want to subject our listeners to
letters, you know, make everyone, oh, good, this week's episode is 2 hours.
Right.
You know.
What's your DVD pick?
Well, it's not exactly a DVD pick.
Okay.
It is a short film that you can see on the internet. Jean-Marie Strobe, legendary, austere European filmmaker, of
of household name Strobe Guillet.
Listen, in this house, Strobe Guillet is a household name.
Only on your behalf.
If you're listening to this podcast, then it probably ought to be a household name in your house, too. Strobe Guillet. Anyway. Madame Mouillet passed away not long ago.
What is the Strobe?
And so Jean-Marie Strobe, still alive, old man now, still making movies. He's made a short film. It's on a website called grasshopperfilm.com. Mm-hmm. I'm going to post the link to the Linoleum Knife Facebook page.
I do this every week.
Yeah, Alonzo's going to do it. Yep. The short film is named The Algerian War with an exclamation point.
Oh, so it's a musical.
Yes. It is 2 minutes long.
I might actually watch this one.
It is a 2-minute film. I encourage everyone to watch this 2-minute film. If you've never seen a Jean-Marie Strobe film, now you can say
you have. There you go.
And then you can go to YouTube and see others that are a lot of them are on YouTube. Okay. I don't know if that's, you know, legal or considered, you know, kosher, but they're so hard to find.
Yeah.
That I don't see a problem with it.
Yeah, if there's not if we're not diverting you away from a revenue stream, you know, there's another way to see these things. I'm like, yeah, I'm okay with YouTube.
These films barely play theatrically. They show up in museums and stuff. But yeah, this is
okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, 2 minutes, you guys, devote yourselves to cinema.
I'm going to go with Unfriended, which was kind of a dopey movie, but I thought it was effective.
Doug unfriended. I had a good time. If other people didn't like
it, I thought it was entertaining, and it looked a lot better after seeing Friend Request. It is a it is a real time online movie about a ghost killing off awful high schoolers in a Skype chat room. It's actually one of the few movies that I think would benefit from you watching it on your laptop.
Maybe.
So, you know, like instead of, you know, streaming it to your TV or whatever, watch it on your laptop and it'll almost feel like it's interactive or something. So, all right.
So here's what's up.
Yes.
Before you say who you should listen to, I'm going to do the little advertisement.
Okay.
Join our club. It's on Patreon. patreon.com/linoleumknife. And if you join our club, you get LKTV, which is a podcast of TV. You get Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast hosted by two film critics. You get Linoleum Nights, which is us just screwing around on the cam for an hour talking about politics and religion and using profanity. You also get some things. Things are great. If you are a Patreon person already and you haven't gotten your things yet, that's because they haven't shipped yet, because I'm running behind, and I'm very sorry about that, but you are going to get your things. And other thing you could do is buy a Linoleum Knife t-shirt from us. They cost $22. And you pay that $22 on PayPal, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We are out of one size.
Which one?
Men's 2X.
Okay.
We have a lot of fatty listeners who all bought those t-shirts. And I can say this to you because I am you.
Say, I wear a 2X.
I wear a 2X myself. And so they're gone. I learned that this week when someone ordered a 2X. And I had to go back to him and say, But we have all the other sizes. And I mean, we have up to 4X. And we have women's sizes in all the sizes. We have some kids' sizes. We got them. Unless you are shaped like us.
And if you live outside the U.S., email us first so we can tell you how much extra postage it will require to get it to your country. So thank you for that. This was the... what was I going to tell you? Oh, well, yeah. And again, please go, if you have not already, subscribe to Who Shot You, which is the new podcast that I'm doing over at Maximum Fun with Ricky Carmona and April Wolf. It's a lot of fun. We just did our third episode about Mother. And I'm hoping it takes off. I'm having a good time doing that show, in addition to all the stuff that we do for our Patreon folks and for you devoted Linoleum Knife listeners. Until next time, go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to Cancel Too Soon and The Schmoes Know. Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Sewers of Paris, The Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes and leave us a review there. It really helps. 5 stars would be great. You can also leave us positive feedback wherever you get this show, at all the streaming places. If there's a streaming place that you like that you aren't getting this show, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com and we can try to fix that. We are on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter @linoleumcast. Again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And that's it. Thank you again, Peter DeBruge, for being here. Thank you, Blue, for our amazing theme music. You can visit him at blutopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And we'll be back next week with more stuff. So until then,
goodbye.